I'll talk to Prime Minister Abe of Japan and others. Great guy, friend of mine. And there'll be a little smile on their face. And the smile is, I can't believe we've been able to take advantage of the United States for so long.
President Trump opening a new front in his trade war. He says the world is taking advantage of the United States. Well, today he took aim at a favorite target, China. He's slapping new tariffs on China, some $50 to $60 billion worth. China will likely respond in kind. There's talk that the country may even target regions of the United States that support Donald Trump. Meanwhile, Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum start tomorrow, but some big U.S. allies are exempt for now, including Mexico, Canada, and the EU. Chris Thornburg is the founding partner at Beacon Economics, and he has some thoughts on this. He joins us now. Hello.
Hey, Madeline, how are you?
Great to have you. Okay, what is the economic argument for tariffs, be it Donald Trump's or anyone else's?
Obviously, you would have to go back to this idea that somehow or other, by using unfair trade practices, these other nations are basically costing the United States income and or jobs. And from a broader perspective, that, shall we say, imbalance is reflected, at least in Donald Trump's eyes, by the fact that the United States runs this relatively large trade deficit. You know, in general, most economists just don't agree with that interpretation of things. Economists recognize that the lack of savings within the United States, the fact that we don't save enough relative to our pace of investment, is why we end up having to go to the rest of the world in the form of running this particular type of trade deficit. It's capital flowing in to make up for our lack of saving. That's the big problem. So I think most economists would simply reject this entire conversation out of hand on that particular basis.
Wait, hang on one second. So let's get our terms straight. How big is the trade deficit with China?
We're talking well over $300 billion.
Okay, but that just reflects that American consumers want to buy more stuff from China than they want to buy from us, right?
That is true. And a lot of economists would also point out that it's not even an appropriate measurement because a lot of the stuff we get from China, say, for example, your iPhone, has components that are actually made in, say, Korea and Japan. And on net, if you actually do what's called a value-added trade deficit, it doesn't look anywhere near as bad for China specifically, but it becomes much worse for places like Korea and Japan that sell a lot of those inputs into those things that are assembled in China. So, yeah, on that basis, yet again, this doesn't seem like a really wise move.
Yeah, because it would, if China responds in kind, then it'll just cost American consumers more to buy stuff at Target, for example.
Maybe, because remember, ultimately, China, while they are a massive producer and certainly a massive exporter to the U.S., at the same time, they have to compete like everybody else does. And there's already been talk, for example, of Foxconn moving some of their facilities out of China to other countries. If they did that, what they would do, for example, is simply shift production away from China to avoid the tariffs, to say maybe someplace like Taiwan or Thailand, and that's the way they could get around it. Mm. And as such, maybe we wouldn't suffer as much. And so this is the thing. I'm a trade guy sort of by training, and I believe in free trade. But I also understand that China is not a nice kid in the sandbox, if you will. And this goes back, I think, to what I would call the kind of guilty little pleasure I have in this, because at one level, I don't like how the administration is pursuing this, nor do I like their stated objectives, that is to say, to close the trade deficit. I do, on the other hand, also recognize that China has, over the years, implemented all sorts of barriers to products and capital flowing into China. They have been accused, justly, of really what I would call rampant theft of American intellectual property. And as a net result of that, while both countries have gained from the rapid expansion of trade between our countries, the Chinese, if you will, have taken, I would argue, a much larger than their fair share of those gains because of the fact that they, just do a lot of things to American exporters that we don't do to them. So at some level, the idea of putting some punitive tariffs out there to get them to play nicer in the sandbox makes a lot of sense. But that's all going to depend on having reasonable objectives. The objective can't be close the trade deficit by $100 billion, which is what was stated today. That's completely illogical. A better objective would be you have to get rid of some of these non-tariff barriers. You have to allow American companies to invest in China without having to have a Chinese partner. These would be appropriate objectives, things that I would actually applaud. You got to remember one thing here, and this is that the Chinese have far more to lose here than we do. About a fourth of Chinese exports of goods come to the United States. China is less than 10% of U.S. exports. When you think about how reliant the Chinese economy is on selling products to the United States, you have to know this is not making them happy. While they may slap back, it's just not going to have the same effect on our economy as our tariffs will have on theirs.
Yeah, but I guess I just don't understand how this will improve the economy here in the United States if we slap tariffs on China. Like, it's not going to create a whole bunch of new jobs in America.
Well, of course. And that goes back to the idea of what our objectives are. Right now, the United States, the unemployment rate's a little bit above 4%. This is full employment. This is as low as it was in 2007, as low as it was in 2000, without, shall we say, the driving force of a massive financial bubble. This is the real deal. We have plenty of jobs. So your point's well taken. What are our objectives? In this case, it's about fairer trade. It's about protecting American rights to, say, intellectual property. It's not about jobs.
Chris Thornburg, founding partner at Beacon Economics. Thanks, Chris.
Pleasure.
Well, as President Trump left that trade announcement today, he was asked this question.
Would you like to testify to Special Counsel Robert Mueller, sir?
Thank you.
Trump said, as he has in the past, he would like to testify in front of Robert Mueller. No commitment, but he may be feeling a little freer since his top lawyer working on the Mueller investigation quit today. John Dowd was reportedly tired of having his advice ignored. It's unclear who will lead the Trump team now, but they have plenty to do as Mueller and others dig deeper into Trump's world and his businesses. And Mueller is reportedly investigating Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner's business dealings. We're going to talk about that now with Andrea Bernstein. She's politics editor at our sister station in New York, WNYC, and co-host of their investigative podcast, Trump Inc. It's a co-production with ProPublica. Hi, Andrea.
Hey, always nice to talk to you.
Great to have you. Okay, so the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia is here in the United States this week, and The Intercept has a story out that says he is claiming, Mohammed bin Salman is claiming that Jared Kushner is, quote, in his pocket. What did he mean by that?
Well, this is not the first time that we've heard that foreign actors believe that they can influence U.S. policy through influencing Jared Kushner. What we know is that this crown prince has forged a personal relationship with Jared Kushner, that they've visited, that they've stayed up till 4 in the morning talking. The Intercept reported that they communicate via the messaging app WhatsApp. They're both in their 30s and sort of, you know, both obviously extremely involved in the politics of their countries. But we have heard before that that U.S. intelligence is anxious that foreign people, because they have these direct relationships with Jared Kushner, who sometimes meets with people without alerting other U.S. officials, there is a concern among the sort of more established diplomatic corps that he's going into these meetings without being fully briefed. The worry is that they can influence the White House because up until January 20th, 2017, Jared was CEO of his family business, the Kushner Companies. And the Kushner Companies is right now seeking to pay off hundreds of millions of dollars in debt on its marquee property on Fifth Avenue. That debt is due in 10 months from now. And because the building is sort of, it's a little bit outdated, it's not something that is going to be a great investment for American investors. So the Kushner Companies has had a strategy of seeking foreign investments because people want to invest in a building in a spot on Fifth Avenue. It's right next to Rockefeller Center. So we have this situation where on the one hand, the Kushner Companies are seeking loans, and on the other hand, Jared Kushner is personally setting up relationships with very important foreign leaders, including the Saudi Crown Prince.
Yeah, and a wealthy foreign leader at that. So Is there any evidence at all that there was any discussion about investing in this property, 666 Fifth Avenue, or making any kind of financial investment at all in the business aspect of Jared Kushner's dealings?
Well, both the White House and the Kushner Company say no. The two are separate. The spokesman for Jared Kushner's attorney has said he has lots of meetings and they are not talking about the family business. Now, the problem is that even if all of that is true, it's impossible to know, is there someone in Saudi Arabia who thinks that because the crown prince has this personal relationship, they can somehow influence U.S. policy by making a favorable financial decision towards the Kushner companies. There was already a story that was reported that after Qatar chose not to invest, that Jared Kushner supported a blockade of Qatar. Now, he says one didn't have to do with another, but this is a situation that you have when you have the president's son-in-law in a powerful position. He has not fully divested from his business. The parts he has divested, he's divested to close family members. And he still owns $761 million of assets. So that is the sort of fundamental instability that even if no one is crossing any lines so far as they can tell, you're still left wondering whose interest is he acting in.
Yeah, and then there was that New York Times story that came out recently where it was apparent he met with two financial firms in the White House, and these financial firms had loaned the Kushners, something like $500 million?
Hundreds of millions of dollars, yeah, for properties in Brooklyn and Chicago. And again, I mean, the response by Kushner's spokesman is, look, we have hundreds of meetings. He's in charge of infrastructure, and he's in charge of innovation, and he's in charge of all these things. That's what he should be doing. He's doing his job in the White House. But then the retort is, well, he has this wide influence, and is it entirely possible that there is nobody in any of these financial institutions that somehow it's crossed their mind that it might be a good idea for them to invest in the president's son-in-law's country and company? And of course, that's heightened because obviously this is a president who plays favorites. We see that almost every minute of every day. So it's would be impossible to believe that somewhere along the line somebody doesn't conclude that they should do these things because it might be a good idea.
Okay, so you mentioned this property, 666 Fifth Avenue, and this marquee location, and yet the property itself has some problems and it needs to be renovated, and he's having trouble finding U.S. investment. How desperate is he for money? What happens if they don't find the money, the $500 million, to pay off the debt? And it's due, as you said, next year.
Well, the Kushner Company says they're in a good financial position and they're not worried and this will be solved in due course. But, I mean, anybody out there has a mortgage understands what the consequences are of not meeting that. So they do have this time pressure. Now, they've already refinanced this building once, so this would be the second refinancing. It was purchased at the height of the market in Manhattan for almost $2 billion, which was at the time the biggest real estate deal of its kind in Manhattan.
Wow. Okay. So that's astonishing.
It's a lot to keep track of.
It is. And so you keep track of that and a whole bunch of other stuff in your podcast, Trump Inc. What is the most surprising thing that you've learned so far?
I think that the sort of thing that I keep getting surprised and caught up in is just how much the norms have shifted in the past year. So before Trump became president, there was a legitimate conversation going on. Would he divest and how would he segregate himself from his companies? And I think there were people who thought he would do it. And then when he said, I'm not going to do it, but he suggested he would create a wall, people sort of believe that would happen. But every day with the president, almost, there is another example of him talking about a Trump property or going to a Trump property. He spent almost a third of his time at Trump properties. We know that he goes to Mar-a-Lago. He goes to the National Golf Course at Bedminster. All of this is somehow cutting down these norms that we thought we're going to keep the president from, you know, sort of promoting a business while also being a president, but that hasn't happened. And then what you see with this Jared Kushner is that not only is there a Trump Inc. situation going on, but there is a son-in-law Inc. situation going on.
Okay, definitely listen to this podcast, Trump Inc. You can download it wherever you get your podcasts. Andrea Bernstein, politics editor at WNYC. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Always great to talk to you.
Coming up, how Facebook is developing sophisticated artificial intelligence to target you with ads, even as it struggles to explain itself in the wake of the Cambridge Analytica scandal. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Mark Zuckerberg went on an apology tour yesterday for how Facebook handled the Cambridge Analytica scandal.
So this was a major breach of trust, and I'm really sorry that this happened. You know, we have a basic responsibility to protect people's data, and if we can't do that, then we don't deserve to have the opportunity to serve people. So our responsibility now is to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
So Facebook will protect users' privacy, but Facebook is also heavily investing in artificial intelligence, AI that could potentially wage even more sophisticated data mining of us. John Herman covers the media for The New York Times Magazine. He's joining me now to talk about this AI and what it might do. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so tell us more about this technology and how Facebook is trying to develop it.
So all the big tech giants now are locked in sort of a new arms race to develop different sorts of artificial intelligence to automate things that they already do, to improve things that they already depend on, and to branch out into new products and services and features for the platform. But to sort of bring that back down to earth, basically Facebook has a very strong interest in using AI to target its ads better, to analyze what we post better, to show us more stuff with more predictive accuracy, or you know, to be able to offer to advertisers a more sophisticated way to target things. It has plenty of other interests in AI. It you know, if it wants to keep going on personal assistants or chatbots, or if it wants to get into the sort of Amazon Echo space more aggressively, it behooves them to invest heavily in artificial intelligence, but for now, the efforts are primarily focused on improving their core product, which means improving basically their advertising business.
So how worried should we be about this? There was a Twitter thread posted by a Google guy who's an expert on this stuff. He's a deep learning expert, I guess. And he said, well, if Facebook gets to decide which news you see, which whose political status updates you see, and who sees yours, then Facebook is, he says, in effect, in control of your political beliefs and your worldview. That sounds really ominous.
It does. And you know, if Facebook is indeed capable of affecting its users' moods, of sort of nudging its users' political beliefs, or inadvertently affecting them in one direction or another, then the fact that they're becoming both more powerful and more automated and less transparent through the use of more and more advanced artificial intelligence, that is certainly alarming. I would note, though, this is someone from Google, and
right.
he did say in this thread, you know, it's lazy thinking to just say two tech companies are the same. You know, sure, Google is investing in similar technologies, but they're very different companies, and so let's not lump everything together. But I also, I think it's worth at least expanding our scope beyond Facebook for this discussion.
Yeah. Basically. Well, I mean, it does seem that Facebook is getting all the scrutiny, and yet all these other companies are doing the same things. They just haven't been caught.
Yeah, certainly. Any company that's built on our personal data, that is built on recognizing patterns in our activities online, in our communications, you know, they should all at least get a basic level of scrutiny about what they're doing and how they plan to use these incredibly powerful tools that will automate this process.
I guess I'm wondering, is it too late for us to rein in this monster as we're
not
seeing it? And because of all this artificial intelligence?
No, not at all. I think a lot of the discussion that we have about artificial intelligence sort of veers into sci-fi territory, where we're thinking about general intelligence you know, unsupervised learning by algorithms and machines that don't need our help to match patterns and come up with new ideas. Basically, you know, brains out in the world. And that's what a lot of research is sort of pointing toward right now and aspiring to, but it's not something that we're very close to. And it's also kind of misleading to base our conversations there, because it makes it feel like, you know, this stuff is on an unstoppable trajectory. It's just accelerating, and it's too late to really think about it. Really, what we have now is some very large, either e-commerce companies, advertising companies, or technology hardware companies like Apple, just trying to sell more of their products or refine the products that make them more money. And then with the extra money they have and with sort of broader goals and ambitions, investing in other things that get closer to this sort of sci-fi reality. And I think one way to remind ourselves that we're not too far along in any of this to change the course of things is to look at what Mark Zuckerberg is saying now about the regrets that he says he has about how things went with Open Graph and Cambridge Analytica, and how users' data was sort of hoovered up and used in ways that they didn't want, as recently as 2011 or 2012. And then you go back to 2016 and find what he was saying about artificial intelligence. And he made it his yearly project then to make sort of a Jarvis-style AI for his house and publish his thoughts on this. He said, we should not be afraid of AI. Instead, we should hope for the amazing amount of good it will do in the world. And he talked about how it might diagnose diseases, enable breakthroughs in astronomy to find new planets, things like that. And he also said it will help with areas that we haven't even thought of today. This is one paragraph after saying no one understands how general unsupervised learning actually works. And his sin in the past has been to emphasize the possibilities that are unknown, and then to also insist that they must be positive and that they must be good, that connecting the world on Facebook's terms must be good, that building communities on Facebook's terms must be good. And here we have him just a couple of years ago saying that building an artificial intelligence on Facebook's terms is probably or necessarily good. And to contrast that with the way that he sounds now trying to do damage control about Cambridge Analytica and about Facebook in general is helpful. It tells us that it's not too late to do anything. It's just time to be a little more critical of these types of statements, to be a little more skeptical of some of these basic assumptions that Mark Zuckerberg and others in positions like his want us to make about what their companies are for and about what they stand for and about where they might take us.
All right, John, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's John Herman. He covers media for the New York Times Magazine. Coming up, what it's like to be a production designer for stop-motion master Wes Anderson.
You don't design a wall outlet that will be maybe 2 pixels high in the frame without Wes saying, yeah, that's a good wall outlet.
Wes Anderson's new film, Isle of Dogs, and one of the guys who had to actually make all those little sets and models, all those puppets, coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Soccer is played professionally in just about every country in the world. And everywhere there are professional teams, there are scouts looking for new talent to give their teams an edge against the competition. The bigger the team, like Manchester United, the bigger the scouting operation. But one search for the next great player outdid them all. It was called Football Dreams, and it held tryouts for more than 5 million young players, mostly across Africa, but also in Latin America and Southeast Asia. Football Dreams was funded by an Arab prince, from the small desert kingdom of Qatar. And those of you who know the game, your ears are probably just perked up because you know that Qatar will also host the World Cup in 4 years. Sebastian Abbott is a journalist. He's a former Islamabad bureau chief for the Associated Press, and he's written a book about the Football Dreams program. It's called The Away Game, The Epic Search for Soccer's Next Superstars. Sebastian Abbott joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, well, let's start at the beginning with this guy, Josep Colomer. He's the guy behind Football Dreams. Tell us more about him and how did he start this program?
So Josep Colomer is an interesting character. He grew up just north of Barcelona in a medieval town called Vic. And even at a young age, he was sort of obsessed with finding and training young soccer talent. And he eventually made it all the way to Barcelona, where he became the youth director of one of the biggest clubs in the world and actually helped launch the career of Lionel Messi while he was there. And when he was at Barcelona, he started scouting in Africa, in Senegal to be exact. And while he was there, he realized that there was so much undiscovered talent in terms of the players he was seeing on the ground when he was going on these scouting trips. And so he came up with this idea of doing a massive talent search. He was just thinking about Senegal at first, actually. But even then, he didn't think he could probably find somebody to bankroll it. He thought it was probably too big even for the biggest clubs in the world. But he would soon discover that there was a country out there with a whole lot more money than any of the biggest clubs that was looking for soccer players themselves.
Right. So Qatar, and how much money were they willing to spend and what were they looking for?
So they've been quite secretive about exactly how much money they've spent on Football Dreams over the last decade. But according to some insiders in the program, it was well over $100 million and maybe even $200 million. And the backstory to this is, as you mentioned, it was a member of the Qatari royal family. He was actually heir to the throne of Qatar. And back more than a decade ago, he decided that soccer, not politics, was his true passion. And he gave up the throne to his brother and decided that he was going to make it his mission to build a world-class Qatari national team. So the first thing he did was he splashed out over $1 billion on one of the most high-tech sports academies in the world, Aspire, hired a bunch of European scouts and coaches, and the first thing they did was held tryouts for every boy in Qatar, which you can do when you only have a couple hundred thousand citizens. And they quickly realized that they needed more soccer talent than they had. So they started scouting piecemeal in Africa and South America. And so they were doing this on a piecemeal basis. But eventually he linked up with Josep Colomer, the Spanish scout, and Colomer pitched him on this idea of doing a bigger talent search in Senegal. And the Qatari Sheikh Jassim said, well, that sounds great, but why just Senegal? Why don't we just do all of Africa? And so in 2007, they launched this incredible program called Football Dreams.
And he'd go anywhere, Josep Colomer, right? So tell about when he goes to the Niger Delta and what happened there.
Yeah, so this is the opening scene of my book. And actually, when I first heard the story, I knew it was going to be the opening scene of my book because it's just an incredible story. This was back in 2007 at the start of the search. And as you said, Colomer was in the Niger Delta, and it was not a safe time to be in the Niger Delta. This was the height of the war between the militants and the government over the oil in the region, and there were lots of kidnappings of foreign oil workers that were taking place. But he was there scouting. He had two paramilitary police guards with him, armed with AK-47s, who were protecting him at all times. And one of the local guys working on the program wanted him to come scout in his local fishing village, which was an hour's boat ride into one of the most dangerous parts of the Delta. And Colomer shows up at the dock to get in his boat. And the local informs him that, well, you can't actually bring your police guards with you because the militants would never allow armed government forces into their territory. But don't worry, I've spoken to the militants and they want you to come. They've never even had a Nigerian scout come visit, much less one who worked for Barcelona, and I have a senior militant leader here who's going to personally escort you. And the police told Colomer he would be insane to go. It was far too dangerous. But again, Colomer had been obsessed with finding kind of the next big star even from a young age, so gets in the boat with this senior militant, and they head off. And luckily, he's able to scout without being kidnapped and makes it back. And I actually went back in 2015 and recreated the entire trip. I went with the same militant, same kind of boat, to the same town and visited the same field he had scouted all those years ago.
And was it successful? Did he find someone amongst the militants?
You know, he didn't find a player that ultimately made it all the way to Doha. There was one that was pretty close. But the thing about it is that, you know, this process was so incredibly selective. As you mentioned, they scouted over 5 million boys, mostly in Africa in the last decade. But they only chose a handful each year to train to become professionals. And the process was over 1,000 times more selective than getting into Harvard.
So how does he know if he's got a star in his hands? And do these kids, I mean, they're in these African villages, they don't necessarily have access to, you know, the top-of-the-line training methods. So how do you find one of these elite players in these villages in Africa?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. You know, as you said, I mean, I traveled widely across West Africa for this book. I spent about 5 months in West Africa, actually. And, you know, you see kids playing everywhere. You know, any place they can find a space, especially in the continent's increasingly crowded cities, they'll play, you know, in under highway overpasses, in cemeteries, on the beach, you know, and usually not good conditions, as you said, the rocks strewn on the field or pools of water. But, you know, they play for thousands and thousands of hours and develop unbelievable skill. And Colomare, actually what he was looking for was not necessarily the biggest player or the fastest player. His philosophy was, you know, it's the player that knows the game, knows how to make the right decisions on the field were the special players for him. And there's actually been research that has shown that this game intelligence or vision is actually one of the best determinants of whether or not a young player has the potential to cut it as a professional and maybe even a star someday. And researchers have found that this game intelligence or vision doesn't come as much from formal practice or games. It actually comes from the kind of street soccer, the pickup soccer that you see so many kids in Africa and South America playing.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Sebastian Abed. He's author of a new book called The Away Game, The Epic Search for Soccer's Next Superstars. So when he finds these superstars, he brings them back to Doha. And just describe the scene that greets them there. As you mentioned earlier, there's this billion-dollar huge sports complex that must stand in stark contrast to where these players came from.
Yeah, again, imagine these players have spent their lives growing up playing on these sort of rocky dirt fields, and then they fly into Doha, and the first thing they see out the window is this sort of blanket of ultra-modern skyscrapers on the coast like nothing they've ever seen. You know, for them, it was like staring into the future. They get out, they go to this billion-dollar sports academy. I mean, Aspire is so spectacular that even the biggest clubs in the world, like Manchester United and Bayern Munich, that go train there in the winter when it's too cold back in Europe, you know, are sort of dazzled by these facilities. And the sort of centerpiece of Aspire is the largest air-conditioned sports dome in the world, which sort of houses, you know, an indoor soccer field, tennis courts, track, pool. And to give listeners an idea of the size, the dome is the size or the width of the Eiffel Tower laying on its side. So it's just absolutely massive.
Yeah. And so how do they do, and how do they lift Qatar's fortunes when it comes to soccer?
You know, they've had kind of a mixed result, which, you know, in some ways you'd expect because, again, it's so difficult to spot talent. In terms of Qatar's own kind of national team, you know, it hasn't really had the impact that I think, you know, Sheikh Jassim probably hoped all those years ago. You know, Qatar failed to qualify for the World Cup again this year, and so will debut when they host the World Cup in 2022. So I think from that perspective, Qatar is probably disappointed, but they still hope to, you know, find and produce, you know, a superstar from the group of kids they still have at the academy that they're training.
Right, and they actually buy a professional team in Belgium to do that, right, to give their players a professional launching pad?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the most amazing parts of the story is that Qatar, because they can do what they want and have a lot of money, they actually went to a Belgian town and bought the local club, which was playing in Belgium's second division at the time. And so it was sort of an incredible story because all of a sudden, you know, the residents of this town of 20,000 people, you know, wake up one morning and their local team, the Pandas, is owned by some Middle Eastern country they've never heard of and filled with African teenagers. And so it didn't really go down well with everyone in town. One of the supporters groups actually boycotted for a year. But the people in the town quickly realized that these players were a lot better than the ones that had been on the team before. And so as the team started winning games, they started winning over the local townsfolk as well.
So you profile three players in the book, and one, he kind of makes it. He's mm-hmm. gets the golden ticket. He gets to play for Barcelona. Mm-hmm. And then another mm-hmm. one is playing for the Norwegian League. But then the third one, and he's one of the strongest players, he ends up back home in Ghana, and he doesn't really have anything to show for this whole time except maybe a tracksuit and some memories. So I guess, how would you assess the Football Dreams program and its success, either in terms of developing talent or for these young men?
Yeah, I think, as you said, I mean, it's a mixed story. And, you know, that third player that you mentioned, Bernard Appiah, is from Ghana, from the capital, Accra. And, yeah, he has a pretty hard luck story. It's pretty heartbreaking. And, you know, one of the reasons for me that it was important to tell his story is because, you know, I'm a big soccer fan. There are a lot of soccer fans out there. But, you know, the side of the game that we see week in and week out, you know, are these stars that are playing on TV and in the Premier League or La Liga, you know, Messi, Ronaldo, Beckham. And the reality is that these players are, you know, just an infinitesimally small slice of all of the players that grow up dreaming of becoming European stars. And for every players whose name you know, there are literally millions whose names you'll never know who didn't make it. And so, you know, Bernard, as you said, he was actually the player who reminded Colomer of Messi when he first saw him and, you know, was seen as having a lot of potential. But, you know, he fell prey to some of the folks around him who, you know, had their own interests at heart and unfortunately didn't make it in the end. And, you know, it was hard telling his story. It was hard seeing that he had fallen from, you know, such heights, at this academy that he'd made it to. He thought his dreams were going to come true and then sort of came crashing down.
Yeah. So how do you see this? I mean, it's kind of the way you're describing it. It sounds almost like neocolonialism in a weird way.
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely a lot of criticism of the program, especially at the beginning. I mean, Qatar put on a lot of fanfare when they launched it. They actually flew Pele over. But they quickly got a lot of backlash, especially from folks in Africa who sort of viewed it through that lens. They sort of saw it as this is another rich country coming to sort of harvest Africa's prized natural resources, you know, taking the best of what a bunch of poor countries have to offer. You know, Qatar insisted that wasn't what they were doing, that it was a humanitarian program, that they were trying to help these kids. But it definitely fell on deaf ears for a lot of people. And, you know, as you said, they saw it through that sort of neo-colonial lens and felt like they maybe were being taken advantage of.
Well, thanks so much. A fascinating story.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It was a lot of fun telling you about it.
Sebastian Abbott, he's author of the new book, The Away Game, The Epic Search for Soccer's Next Superstars. Coming up, the production designer for the new Wes Anderson film, Isle of Dogs, is here. One fun fact from our upcoming interview, they used real dog fur on their puppets. That's right. That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The film Isle of Dogs is the latest foray into stop-motion animation from Wes Anderson. It takes place in a futuristic Japan where an evil mayor has banned all dogs to a place called Trash Island. It's there that we meet a pack of eccentric ex-house pets who are losing hope after months of eating, well, trash. They're led by Chief, who's voiced by Bryan Cranston, a stray with a troubled past.
Nobody's giving up around here, and don't you forget it, ever. You're Rex.
You're King. You're Duke. You're boss.
I'm Chief. We're a pack of scary, indestructible alpha dogs.
The film is an incredible feat of design and animation. The dogs and human characters played by extremely detailed puppets. More than 1,000 of them were used in the movie, along with hand-painted mini dioramas and who knows how many miniature props. Paul Harrod oversaw the production of Isle of Dogs, and he joins us now. Hi.
Hi there.
Okay, so looking at the credits on this film, it seems like a small army went into making this movie. Can you describe the look of it and your vision for the look of it?
Absolutely. Adam Stockhausen, my colleague, my co-production designer, and Wes, and I looked at a lot of work by Japanese artists from the Edo period, the yukioi illustrations, screens, woodblocks, and that sort of thing, and took these oftentimes pastoral landscape illustrations and translated them into piles of trash.
And so you would have to also build individual tiny, tiny pieces of trash?
Yes. In a lot of cases, we had very specific trash in the background. A heap of cars, for instance. Piles and piles of detergent bottles. Old washing machines and refrigerators. One of the sets is made entirely of broken cathode ray tubes and car batteries.
And describe what the beach looks like.
The beach, if you're talking about the crash site, is made entirely of discarded newspapers. And actually, the newspapers are very detailed, although you'll probably never see that, no matter how hard you look in a film. But they're actually newspapers with Japanese text and, in some cases, real articles.
Well, so it sounds incredibly detail-oriented, to put it mildly. Well, can you walk us through how stop motion works? So when you're filming a scene, how do you actually do it?
Well, in the case of stop motion, we're working on dimensional sets with puppets that are poseable. They have steel ball and socket armatures inside them. And then in the case of this film, unlike a lot of stop motion work, we're working with real fabric clothing and on the dog's real hair. Andy Gent, who was the head of our puppet fabrication department, just did an amazing job with these dog puppets that have very intricate mechanisms within the face that allow the animator to move the muscles in the face around, and they'll hold their position so that you can do this work one frame at a time and create the illusion of constant motion. One of the reasons for going with real fur was that Wes really liked the idea of there being a breeze running through the place the whole time, so you get what you call crawl, and this worked really nicely to create a constant sense of motion even when the characters are still.
Wow. And it sounds like an incredible process. It must have taken a very, very long time. How long did it take?
Well, I think start to finish the film was about 3 years. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
It takes a while.
Very time consuming.
So it makes me wonder why. What is the overall objective? Why choose this form to tell the story? Because I guess on the other end, you could shoot a film on an iPhone. and with real people, and it would take, you know, a couple weeks or something. I don't know. Maybe I'm overstating it.
Well, I think the key thing here is control. Unlike any other form, animation allows you to completely create a world whole cloth. There is nothing that you see in Isle of Dogs that wasn't made for that film.
In terms of animation, why choose this form of animation as compared to hand-drawn or computer animation?
I think there's a love of shape and texture. It produces its own peculiar qualities. For instance, computer animation, you can really chase reality. At this point, the technology is so sophisticated that things like explosions and water and all that can be synthesized quite effectively and look pretty much like the real thing. I think what Wes really wanted was to go after a very handmade look. And in fact, things like water and explosions were all handmade too. The explosions are made usually out of cotton wool, sometimes with lighting effects inside them, and hand animated to create the appearance of a cloud or an explosion. And the water was all made out of cling film on perspex that is hand manipulated to create the illusion of waves and crashing surf and whirlpools and things like that.
Wow, that sounds incredible. And how does that advance the story? And you know, how does this, the look that you oversaw, illustrate the story that you want to tell?
It's a means by which one can really be drawn into a world that feels tangible and touchable. And I think it serves the story in providing a real sense of place. We built 250 sets, which I think may be something of a record for a stop-motion animated feature. It certainly felt like it.
Did you ever get frustrated, like, oh, it's so niggly and so detail-oriented? Did you ever just feel like it was too much?
Absolutely. Always. I mean, you know, you always sort of find yourself questioning, really, are we going to really see this? And in fact, I think there are a huge number of details that on a first viewing are just going to be completely missed. You're going to miss more than, you know, 75% of the details within the shot because of the because of Wes's pacing. The film really clips along, and we have sets that appear for little more than a second, entire sets.
And how long would that 1 second take to construct and film?
Well, most of the really short ones, some of the those really short shots took a crew of maybe six people, you know, a month to build. That's not including the time that it took to execute the conceptual illustration and do all the sort of architectural drafting for it. But I think it pays off in the end. And I'm hoping that all of that intense detail will invite people to see the film more than once.
And does Wes Anderson approve every single prop, every single shot? Is he
absolutely
there?
Everything goes through Wes. You don't design a wall outlet that will be maybe 2 pixels high in the frame without Wes saying, "Yeah, that's a good wall outlet."
What's a bad wall outlet?
One that Wes doesn't like.
Thank you so much. This was really fun, really interesting.
You're certainly welcome.
That's Paul Harrod. He's the production designer for Wes Anderson's latest film. It's called Isle of Dogs, and it's out in theaters tomorrow. And that's it for this particular wall outlet. I'm Al Graham. I'll see you tomorrow.